KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I welcome you to another edition of the show. Today, I am very pleased to have on with me the author of several seminal works in the world of technology, but the one for which he is most known and that we're going to be discussing today is Technosis. The author is Eric Davis, and Technosis is a book of staggering importance to anyone that really thinks long and hard about how we got to the technological society that we have today. He is also the founder and author and content creator for the website technosis.com. But the subtitle of Technosis is really the jumping off point for our discussion today. And the subtitle is Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information. And it's a title which really suggests to you kind of the broad-ranging topics that Eric discusses in his book. And it ranges from going back to pre-Jesus thinking, the Platonic world, and thinking about what it means without the world of a monolithic and a single God, and how people viewed their role in society, right up through the Middle Ages, into the early world of technology, and right up to today. And while Technosis came out in the late 90s, the more recent version of Eric's book has an afterforward that takes a look really at what those predictions and thoughts were when the book was first written, which was right at the cusp of the internet bubble, and then where we are today. Eric's prognostications are quite prescient. Many have happened. Some have changed. We're going to talk about some of those. But the book itself is an amazing compendium of information from the Stoics to it's so broad that I'd rather just start the conversation with Eric himself and see where it leads. This show is being recorded on November 17th, but I suspect that in the intervening few weeks before I put the show on the air, things will not change drastically, although you never know with technology. So Eric, thank you for coming today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in and start with kind of the basic question to set the context. Technosis. The title, why, what does it mean?
Right. That's a good one. I can't say in my own brain I remember coining this term. However, as is often the case, things like this are floating around in the zeitgeist, and a few people have shown me an obscure science fiction story and an early ad for the early cyber culture magazine, Mondo 2000, I believe, used the term at some point. But for me, it basically slams together two abiding themes that are really important to me that are not often seen together, but it's the juxtaposition of them that really drives my research in this book and a lot of my interest since then, which is this combination of technology, which we tend to associate with the works of the rational mind, with our products of reason, with gnosis, which is one of a many terms you could choose for a kind of mystical knowledge. So the aspect of knowledge that can't be so easily quantified or turned into a calculating machine, and yet it does have a certain kind of noetic or mental ascendancy associated with it, which is not unrelated to some of the themes and attractions and seductions of technology, particularly computers and media technology. So for me, it was a single term that kind of forced together these two stories that I'm so interested in, you know, the relationship of our products of reason in technology, and particularly media technology, and these deeper, older, sublime but still present aspects of human aspiration in terms of consciousness and mind.
So, unfortunately, I'd love this to be a six-hour show, though it would wear you out. We are going to, unfortunately, have to only touch the tip of these issues, and there's so many right there. In fact, I could probably just say, please discuss, and then I could, you know, go out for 40 minutes and we'd still be going. By way of your background, because it kind of leads to my next question, which is how you got to writing a book like this. You're based in San Francisco, and you identify yourself as a culture critic as well as an independent scholar. You've written for a ton of magazines, from Wired, ArtBite, LA Weekly, etc. But you've also written for a magazine called Gnosis. And it's an unusual background that you have. So if you would, and your work itself, you know, runs the range, as we were discussing before we went on the air today, from an outstanding study of Led Zeppelin IV for 33 and a third to your most recent book on California mysticism, which we'll discuss shortly. Tell me how you got to the point where you could write a book as broad as Technosis.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I've always been interested in mysticism, the religious imagination, the cosmic imagination. When I was in high school, I was really into science fiction, and I was into epic space operas and music that would match such kinds of material. And then in college, I kind of hooked into a certain way of thinking about technology through, Jean Baudrillard was kind of the campus hit hero then of the world of simulations, and just thinking about the future and thinking about technology in a way that combined a sort of science fictional sense with critical thinking. And because I was always interested in this kind of mystical side of science fiction, if you will, that these things all became connected in my view. So, for example, the writings of Philip K. Dick were extremely important because they combined all of these modes, a technical self-awareness about how technology works, how it constructs realities, an abiding sort of philosophical and even mystical concern with the ultimate nature of consciousness and reality and epistemological questions, and also a real gritty sense of the reality of popular culture, of living in California, of the kinds of things that happen when all of these highfalutin ideas and technologies actually hit the street and you're dealing with ordinary people's lives, so the kind of anthropology of ordinary life. So all of those things were always fascinating to me. So I usually mention Dick as the kind of figure that combines all of these characters. I wrote my senior thesis on Dick's work. And so when I went on and become a journalist, I kind of followed simultaneously all of these threads while doing more kind of scholarly research on the backstory of this connection between media and consciousness.
It's a topic that lends itself to, I think initially, and I want to get your reaction to it, to kind of a whoa kind of reaction. I mean, when I first picked up your book, which was a few years ago, I'm certainly never anyone that I wouldn't think of myself as a mystic. I wouldn't think of myself as someone into mysticism. And I think the subtitle really lends itself to the basic question of, where was it, or at what point did you see that there was this connection between what we call the information society? And you spend a good amount of time in your book even dissecting the word information, which I'd like to get into as well. But at what point did you see that there was a direct connection between what was happening in the late 90s in the technological world and this base of knowledge of mysticism and the history of religious thought and of the role of man that colored your analysis growing up?
No, it's a great question. I think one of the tricky things about the book that's not altogether clear, or even my approach to thinking about things in general, is that while I'm very interested in religious and mystical themes and images, it's not that I am principally focused on them. It's rather that I think that those are an amazing place to sit in order to understand other kinds of changes in society. So they're like great lenses to put on. And I think I got that understanding historically. I was always tuning into the fact that there was this science fictional element to discussions of new technology, and that there was inevitably a mythic or mystic side, even if in a very pop and corny way, to that kind of science fiction imaginary. So that, for example, reading William Gibson's novels in the 80s, which really helped shape the early imagination around quote-unquote cyberspace or the internet, even though Gibson himself is a very dry secular critic in terms of his approach to reality as a novelist, he opens up space for a kind of transcendental mysticism in terms of the oneness of the artificial intelligence. And then in the second novel, he turns towards Haitian voodoo as a model for understanding these different kinds of intelligences. So there's something about the mythic imagination that lends itself to the open-ended qualities of so much information space. It's not an accident that the dominant metaphors of these computer games that now, in the age of massive multiplayer online games, is really taking off. This is really where we're seeing the emergence of a kind of collective virtual world, that the dominant metaphors in so many of those games, in the leading games, have a quality of magic to them. That's not an accident, either historically, in terms of where these ideas came from in the history of mythological modes in terms of the development of games, or I would argue psychologically or psycho-spiritually, that there's something about the difference that is introduced by information environments, the internet, hacker digging down into codes, the ways in which we interact with our increasingly sort of, you know, I like to call them angelic communicators that we carry around with us.
Right.
That as we go and engage those things, mythological and religious metaphors and feelings come up whether or not we're actually necessarily aware of them. So once I had that insight, I looked back and I could see that the history of media was littered with evidence of this approach, that if you go back and you look at the role of the scroll or the book in early Christianity and early Judaism, if you look at the emergence of electricity as a communications device in the 19th century, over and over again, you see the conjunction of new media and a transformation or an opening into a different kind of religious space, a different kind of mythological metaphors that help us understand who we are. So once I saw that connection, I kind of had to like try to tell the whole story.
Right. And in a power-packed, factually intense book, I think you've done that. I, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm thrilled to have you here and there's so much to discuss. So rather than continuing to pat you on the back, let's get into some of those things. You mentioned let's turn first towards your discussion of the roles of the role of writing in the Jewish world versus the Christian world and in other early religions. And you talk about the Hebrew alphabet as an example of this, of obviously of a writing structure, but also that it had other meanings beyond merely the letters. And you contrast that in the book with as you mentioned, the codex, rather than the scroll version, which in fact, as you know, is still carried today as the Torah when the Torah is raised. And David Levine, incidentally, is a Jewish name for those that aren't familiar. So I'm very familiar with that. But talk a little bit about the comparison that you draw, which is certainly not one that would be self-evident, I think, to those thinking about how technology operates today.
Sure. This is a caveat. Obviously, I'm talking in big brush strokes, but it's a style that I think is pertinent and necessary when we're looking at these large frameworks.
Sure.
There's two different distinctions in the way that Judaism and early Christianity engaged the technology of writing. And part of my argument here is that again, it's no accident that the role of the book or the text plays such an incredibly important role in all the religions of Abraham and as well as Islam, and that to the degree to which these religions, in particular Judeo-Christianity, have affected and transformed the nature of civilization, that it has to do with in many ways with the technology of writing, and that this ends up having the writing itself carry a kind of sacred charge. So the trick then is to look very closely at the technology of these matters, which is a line from a Pynchon book, and then through that you get to understand some of these transformations in culture and consciousness that are happening. One interesting distinction is that the actual letters of Hebrew were considered to have mystical qualities inherent in their particular shapes, and this comes from an older, if you would sort of more archaic way of looking at the marks we make as having a kind of divinatory power in them.
Mm-hmm.
This contrasts not only with Greek, but particularly with Roman characters. The Roman characters that we use have never had that kind of mystical density associated with them. In fact, they speak of a different world, not of the kind of archaic world of magical glyphs, but instead a more modern language of translatability, a language of globalism. And in fact, that's partly what you see, is that the situation within which Judaism arises is a tribal situation with powerful archaic and what we would have to call pagan aspects to it. Christianity emerges in the context of an essentially globalized Greco-Roman world. This is seen in another real distinction between these two technologies of writing, between the scroll and the codex book. The codex book, which was taken up by a lot of early Christians, it's like Paul's letters were distributed in the form of codices, is that the codex was a very practical, unromantic kind of media technology. It was something that was used by shopkeepers. They would have a kind of wax in them sometimes. It'd be like a wax writing tablet where you could erase it and then they would move on as a place to kind of keep records. So it was a very lowly, but also a very transportable device. And not only was it easy to transport, but that it opens up something that scrolls do not, which is random access. It's very easy to jump around inside of a codex in a way you can't jump around inside of a scroll. Now, Judaism would develop all sorts of other ways of annotating text in incredibly rich ways, and looking at a 17th century edition of the Torah is an amazing introduction to hypertext and to multiple layers of text and how fonts can function. I mean, they're designer's dreams.
Right.
But Christianity also more readily lend itself to a certain style of citation that you can see even in preachers today, where they're moving, there's a way of like citing scripture and jumping around in order to cobble together some kind of version of Christianity, because that's all we have are these versions of Christianity that clearly emerges from this particular technology. It's the formal characteristics of different media technologies have a direct and powerful force on the consciousness and culture that is associated with those technologies.
It's a fascinating area, and in fact, you quote David Perush. Am I pronouncing that correctly? But it's a tough one.
So.
Yeah, I think that's right. David Perush, the quote that you use is every time, and this is him, every time culture succeeds in revolutionizing its cybernetic technologies and massively widening the bandwidth of its thought tech, it invites the creation of new gods. And the new god concept is something that runs through your book. And in again, given the limited time we have, I'd like to touch on at least some of those new gods and see where they take us. And I want to turn to just what's really a few pages later in the book Technosis. And by the way, I realize that I probably should spell it for those people that are wondering how that's spelled, but that's T-E-C-H-G-N-O-S-I-S. But you talk about the fact that in the Christian world there was a need to literally move around, that people were carrying these books, and that therefore there was a need to change the way that writings were developed. The hypertext connection that you draw is a fascinating one. And I guess I want to press you on that a little bit and ask it this way. What we have today in hypertext, and for those people that aren't familiar with what that term means, it effectively is when you click on a link on a web page and lead to another sort piece of material on another page. The hypertext concept is something that has, as we all know, has made the internet largely what it is, the fact that you can jump from place to place. And I'm curious, you mentioned the Torah commentaries and other ways that people were able to annotate and comment on the world around them. Do you find that trend was an upward spiral through time, or were there times in the history as you saw it when people were not looking for information for that technology of that day to allow them to broaden their thinking but to circumscribe it?
Now, that's a very good question. Yeah, I wouldn't say that there's a steady march upward in complexity. I suspect that if you even just look at that particular example of hypertext, which is always related to commentary. So when you have more commentary on more texts and then you're trying to organize commentary, you're going to move into that direction. That's going to happen more or less at later stages in the development of a religion or a philosophical system or a culture. So, for example, in Tibet, by the 13th, 14th century, you are also getting these compendia of commentary embedded within commentary, embedded within commentary, at the heart of which is a single line of a sutra. Or a scripture. But that kind of comes up partly as a reflection of the complexification of a culture or of a religious system. And I think that simultaneously, is particularly if you're talking about religion, calls up an opposite desire, which also has technological outcomes. But the opposite desire is to return to a kind of directness, a kind of immediacy, a simplicity of a direct experience or a fully awakened knowledge, which is part of what gnosis means. Gnosis mm-hmm. means knowledge, but it really means a kind of immediate mystical understanding that has, depending on who's talking, actual informational elements to it. So I think that sometimes in development of society, you have the opposite desire, which is to strip away the layers of commentary. And in fact, part of the appeal of electronic media, radio, television, is that it has a kind of immediacy that is not particularly hypertextual, is not particularly lends itself to layers of visual a commentary, but instead has this kind of appeal of a more face-to-face or auditory directness, what McLuhan talked about, a kind of acoustic property as opposed to the visual properties of Gutenberg or writing-based technologies.
It's a fascinating development, and it's one that you discuss in some detail, the utopian theories that came out of the Renaissance, really, period. And I was struck by some of the literature that you cited in doing this analysis. And having read Mumford's works on utopias, I was interested to see that you also quoted Pico della Mirandola's Oration on the Dignity of Man, which, for those that don't know, is really a classic, and some would argue the classic, statement of man's acceptance of their role in controlling their fate. And obviously that's something that flew in the face of many religious people of the time, and indeed is still a very controversial point. But you draw that connection to technology, and that technology gives us that opportunity. And I just want to develop that a little bit, which you develop in your book, but discuss it a little bit here, which is the idea that technology, in fact, makes us more human rather than less human. And throughout your book, you challenge this notion. But drawing from the Hermetica, which you also spent a lot of time on, and Pico della Mirandola and others, describe for the listeners, if you would, what that connection is.
Yeah, that's a great question and very germane, particularly today where transhumanist arguments are becoming more prevalent, and transhumanism being basically this question that we're now being able to see beyond so many of the limitations that we consider to be part of the quote-unquote human condition, and mm-hmm. that in fact we're at a place where we're passing into a sort of post-human or transhuman condition where we're maybe rewriting some of these fundamental laws that we think make us who we are. So who are we? And some people are very nervous about these transformations, the conservatives, and some people are very exuberant about them, the transhumanists. And I guess what I'm pointing to is that this dynamic dilemma, if you will, has really been in the cards for quite a long time. And though Pico de Mirandola is not thinking about technology per se when he's talking about this, what he does recognize is that man's quote-unquote nature is to not be completely determined by nature, the mm-hmm. way that we look around us and we see other animals, and those animals may have human-type characteristics. The more we learn, the more we find that we're not that different from animals, that elephants have, you know, memories and emotional attachments, and they get pissed off and resentment, and there's revenge, and monkey, you know, whatever, there's language. All these things right. that we thought were clearly defined humans is less so. But one thing that it does seem to define us is that we're capable of recognizing our animal dimension, and to some degree transcending it, and that transcendence is part of who we are, and it's also part of why we do the things we do, including making technologies, mm-hmm. which in many ways circle round and increase the range of things that we can now determined directly, technologically, or through power. So in that sense, technology is this kind of extrusion of an element in us that goes, you know, quite far back. I mean, you can imagine other ways, other parallel universes where technology developed very differently than it did in our universe. I'm not saying that the way we have technology now is necessary precisely because we are open, self-creating creatures in many ways. So in that sense, I do agree with the transhumanists that our nature is to redefine our nature, and that this reflects both the reality of technological development and other kinds of social development, for sure, but also has a spiritual characteristic, which is there is a kind of Promethean dimension to us that you know creates a counter myth to the dominant myths of Christianity, which sort of has a stay inside of a certain definition, a certain kind of role. But I can only see a kind of unleashed Promethean myth driving a lot of this stuff.
And that Promethean myth, to use your term, is something also that runs through your book. And kind of we're coming towards the bottom of the hour to take a short break, but one of the things that's striking about your book, and there are books that try to take a look at technology from different perspectives, and sometimes those books often suffer from either having a way too optimistic and glowing view of the role of technology, and others, not as much recently, although some are coming out on issues involving attention spans and the decline of leisure. But you did see books in the past that were very dark about technology ruining human nature. And your book, and certainly what you discuss both in the beginning of the book and the end, kind of ruse the fact to some degree that we will lose some of our human elements and that we might lose them in the crush of wanting to commodify and also use information in ways which may or may not ultimately serve the human condition as you see it. And of course, we're at the bottom of the hour, so I can make this an impossible question to answer in 1 minute, so I'm going to narrow it down a little bit and say, if there's a purpose to your book in terms of saying whether technology, to use very bland terms, is good or bad, where would you come out at the end of the day on that? And we can develop it more at the bottom of the hour. Did you find as writing the book that you were looking to develop it in one direction or another, or see where it led?
I was more trying to create a deeper resonance to all the technological developments that we look at, that we tend to look at fairly simply, in order to reflect the very problem that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that our own individual engagement with technology, social engagement with technology, could not be seen in simply rational, efficient terms. That they are all loaded, and they're loaded ultimately with ultimate questions, and they're haunted as well by specters of the past and by specters that we carry inside of us, that we see in our media, that we see in our dreams, and that these specters are part of us as well, and that we cannot neatly divide the technological decisions we make from the implications of these other dimensions of human culture and human consciousness.
I want to develop those implications in at the following the music break, and also talk about your new work on California mysticism, which ties into this. You are listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine from the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I'm pleased today to have Eric Davis, the author of Technosis, as well as several other fascinating works on today. Before we go back to conversation with Eric Davis, I want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour and start begging you for money. So here we go. Get ready, or if you want to run away for 30 seconds, I suppose you can do that too. If you love what you're listening right now, and I hope you do, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, and hearsay culture. By visiting kzsu.stanford.edu and clicking on Donate to KZSU, or emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, you can do your part to make sure that the independent sound and the shows that run on the station never disappear. So, Eric, we're back. And at the bottom of the hour, we were talking about this humanizing nature of technology. And again, you know, it's got to be interesting to hear yourself quoted back to you. But I'm going to do it again, except this time I'm actually going to quote you. And for those of you that are following along in the book, on page 148 of the paperback version, the most recent version of Technosis, you point out what you call the real wonder, and you say, information technology allows even the most hardcore materialists to ruminate once again on the ancient dream of slipping the incorporeal spark of the self through the jaws of death unscathed. And I want to talk about that a bit. It's the dream nature, the mystical world that we're examining here. And you spoke at the very beginning about games like Zork and these games that allowed people to transport themselves either just by way of text into mystical worlds. Tell me what you mean by that statement and why that's the wonder of information technology.
Sure. There's a general comment to make is that one of the things that I found and one of the things that I wanted to bring forward is the way that so many of our technologies are realizing dreams that were dreamt long ago and in very different contexts. And for some, you know, people that'd be saying, oh, so what? So back in the day they thought we could fly, or they thought we could, you know, transmit information instantaneously through, you know, angelic presences, you know, in some kind of astral world or whatever the crazy idea is. Well, that, you know, that's silly. Now we're doing it some other way. To me, that resonance is meaningful, that it ties us to a kind of dreaming aspect or a kind of fantasizing aspect of the human mind that is imagining possibilities, alternatives, that is imagining aspects of the self that are unrealized and that has this kind of calling towards a kind of more realized self that's liberated from some of the constraints of matter and the body. That's part of what Gnosis is about, is that kind of transcendent dream. In terms of the specific quote, this gets us back a little bit to the transhumanists, is this irony that for some people who are taking, you know, their technological, their scientific versions of human self as seriously as possible, it's like, no, we are totally meat machines. The mind is nothing other than a program running in the brain. Well, if you really take that far enough, then there's no reason that we couldn't, in principle, build a substratum that it was the equivalent to the brain that was able to run the same program. And so then suddenly you find yourself in this kind of Mobius strip where even your pursuit, your movement away from enchanted ideas, from flim-flam from the past, from fuzzy notions, fuzzy dualistic notions about the soul, right, and you've been running away from that, and then you find yourself suddenly with a similar dream, but not necessarily with the same ability to deal with the consequences of that dream.
Here's probably the shortest question that I can ask. Does artificial intelligence disturb you? Are you bothered by it?
What I'm more bothered by than the idea of artificial intelligence is I am concerned that as we construct an idea or a story about artificial intelligence working in society and we attribute to it powers that it doesn't necessarily have, that we will create a situation where stupid machines are making high-level decisions because we don't know how to deal with it, but our ability to question that development is hamstrung because there's a story about how these are artificial intelligences and that they are actually quite sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So, for example, right now, one of the things that's happening is there's just way too much information. So we might worry about the surveillance society. There's all these cameras, and they're coming. There's more and more down the pike. We're just the tip of the iceberg on this stuff. Even in, you know, Homeland Security, they're right, like giving them those multi-million-dollar grants to put cameras everywhere. Okay,
right.
So then you have all those cameras everywhere, recording all that information into what? Into a bunch of databases. Well, wouldn't it be nifty if we had, like, little smart spiders that were able to do facial recognition, that were able to recognize what quote-unquote suspicious behavior was, in fact, to feed that back into a system. Well, all that's a little sci-fi right now, but it's not that sci-fi 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have too uncritical an idea about artificial intelligence, I'm concerned that that story will enable a lot of really dumb technologies and maybe even pernicious ones to begin to have even more direct impact on our lives.
On the human side of that, and to personalize it, there's a concern even among the legal community that if we start creating machines that can actually write law and do that balancing, that aside from the effect that it would have on creating a machine that's supposed to factor in more than just an algorithm, but factor in human concerns that may change from minute to minute, you're also going to simply, from the very basic standpoint, make it less necessary to have human beings doing any of these things, which leads to that apocalyptic concern that certainly many people expressed early on in development of the computer, and that you hear less so now. But I'm wondering, because you mentioned it, and I wanted to touch on it, I think this is a good time to do it. We now, especially post September 11th, have an increasingly surveillance-based society. And in fact, notwithstanding the most recent election, it's clear that many people are willing to forego any concern about who's looking at them or why or what have you, and really what this technology is doing, in the interest of saying, well, we're in a different age. I'm curious to get your reaction to the point that things are different now. And you are an ideal person to ask, because you've looked at this. How different is the world now in terms of its need for this surveillance than it was in the past?
That's fascinating. I would approach that from the point of view that things are different in the sense that what we think of as privacy is really going away in large part. And privacy itself is, of course, you know, is a historical thing. It wasn't like, you know, the tribesmen running around Serengetis or, you know, trying to throwing rocks at Neanderthals, right, were concerned about privacy. Mm-hmm. Privacy is very much a construct of you know, that occurs in different societies, and there's ways to mark power, ways, you know, there's all sorts of stuff around it. Nonetheless, I do think that the spread of these technologies is changing, not just in the sense that people are making arguably rational trade-offs where they say, well, I'm willing to give up this in exchange for that. That still implies a kind of interior agent who's making those rational decisions. What I'm more concerned about is that we reach a certain point of a kind of feedback loop where that position who even just thinks they're making decisions isn't really doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. And another side of the surveillance is not the hard surveillance that comes from the state or even from corporations, but the way that we're surveying ourselves, or the way that we're constantly translating ourselves into video, into photography, into recordings, the way that we're increasingly breaking down the division between recording and experience, mm-hmm. and then taking those recordings and sharing them and feeling that there's some kind of translation of presence or something by sharing these recordings of our experience. Well, we're really, I think, we are changing really transforming that, the seat of the self. What does it feel like to be a self with an interior and with an exterior who's navigating these divides? The divides themselves are changing rather drastically, it seems to me.
And I agree with that statement 110%, and I think it leads us to a question which I'm going to ask at the end, which is, where do you think we're headed now today in late 2006 in light of, and I'll politicize it a little bit, but in light of the change that we now have in the leadership in the Congress. But let me turn in the remaining 10 minutes or so that we do have to talk about your new book and the new work that you have. And it's called The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape. And it obviously develops on the some of the themes that you have in Technosis. Let me ask you this. I mean, you draw this connection to California now, specific mysticism. And I wanted to ask the question, is there, I'm of course initially ask you to maybe summarize it, you know, it's the easy time, just summarize your whole book in 1 minute. But then after you do that easy part, is there a reason that California has been the place where so many new technologies come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was interested in the visionary state, is to just answer the question, why did so much weird stuff happen in California? Why do we rightly associate the place with all of these fads and sects and cults and strange new religious movements and, you know, Asian religions transplanted here and psychedelic culture and, weird subcultures of all variety. Why did that happen? And so my book is really an attempt to tell that story through photography by Michael Rauner. Really took very beautiful photographs to kind of tell the story by telling, by moving through the landscape of the state as a way to sort of trace all of these histories. But to my mind, there is a very deep and intimate relationship between the incredibly important role that California played in the development of technology, of media technology in particular, but not just media technology, and this story that I'm telling. I get to it at the final chapter of the book where I'm really trying to weave it all together in terms of this vast story that I'm telling you about. But that they both share a certain kind of restlessness and a sense of innovation and a sense of openness, but also a kind of a kind of drive. And the drive may be towards hedonism. It may be towards making things more efficient. It may be towards trying to show the possibilities for a transformative function in society, but they're all deeply related. I mean, there's a, you know, I'm going to blow his name, Stanford professor from cyberculture to, from counterculture to cyberculture, Norman, right?
Mm-hmm.
He tells the story very well, and it's a very important story to emphasize how much there is a connection between the consciousness revolution, which I'm really describing in the visionary state, and the technological revolution that I'm talking about in technosis, or the technological change of consciousness. And in some ways, they look very different books, but in other ways, they're very related.
Is to explore that a little bit. One thing you do discuss in Technosis, and that you develop here, is the idea that the culture in California was one of experimentation. How much of it may sound like an obvious question, but how much of the experimentation nature of human beings, the ability to be curious, the ability to want to explore even at their own risk, you know, the classic, you know, old saying, curiosity killed the cat. And I'm wondering, in California specifically, is there something about what happened here and the development here that lends to that curiosity? We see it not just in the Bay Area where we are right now, but it clearly exists as well in 1 hour plane ride from here in Hollywood, where the entertainment industry, while it's been criticized for a whole host of reasons involving how it's used technology and rights, no one can dispute the fact that Hollywood has been driving in large measure, for better or for worse, cultural development in the United States. So I'm curious, what is it, if you would summarize it, what would be the core reason that mm-hmm. California's been the center of this?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of them. In terms of the Bay Area, it's, I think, fair to invoke the fact that the people who came out here for the gold rush were an unusually cosmopolitan lot. They were people from all over the world. In fact, it was probably the most cosmopolitan place in the middle of the 19th century because people were from everywhere, mostly men.
Mm-hmm.
The people who would do such a crazy thing were largely risk takers to a certain degree. So on the one hand, you have this kind of risk-taking culture, which, if you want to get genetic determinists about it, is actually in the gene stock, but at the very least sets in motion a sort of goal that other people will then emulate later and later. At the same time, California in the 19th century was industrialized more quickly than almost anywhere else in the United States. So it has always been a profoundly modern place, one in which technology, the relationship of technology and wealth, and the drive to make wealth and enjoy wealth were always very, very strong, very, very hedonistic place in some important ways, which mixes with other American tendencies. So you have a really ripe situation there for the kind of technological innovations that they're going to see. And so you can invoke Hollywood, but even before it, Edward Muybridge, right around here in the Stanford mm-hmm. campus, is one of the first guys to really create cinema. And there's a number of these television comes from San Francisco. I mean, there's a lot of kind of peculiarly enchanted things, genetic engineering, early radar work, mm-hmm. aerospace industry, etc. But I also believe that what's happening is a deeper story, that, and this is a painting with very broad brush, but I still think it has some merit, which is that in some ways the United States is, I won't say the culmination, because in some ways it's kind of a bastardization, but it's the end point of the development of European civilization, that it the leading edge of this kind of civilization, which is defined in part by technology and by science and by a kind of imperial claim and a kind of broad, a kind of visionary wanderlust. So, you know, Europe not only invents all these machines and goes into science, but it also becomes an imperial power, not just because it wants goods, but because it's that's what it wants to go around the world.
Right.
You know, you don't see quite the same extent. So there's something in that expansive, in many ways violent and horrific story about Europe that is sort of culminates in an American story. And America's expansive story culminates in the Pacific Ocean, where it literally runs against itself and it has nowhere to go. It faces the void. Story's over, guys. What are you going to do now? And there's a kind of a refusal in California, which is, you know, aided and abetted by all sorts of industries that are making money off of it, but there's a kind of cultural refusal to just accept the limitations. And instead, the frontier is no longer external, it's internal, or it's technological, or it's in the imagination, in the sense of how can we make the imagination, how can we materialize it in media through film, through, you know, the internet, through, you know, taking the mind stuff and making it some place that we can go or some place that we can sort of engage each other through. So it seems that both like culturally, historically, and to some extent almost geographically, that it exists on this kind of fringe point, even literally. We're sitting atop of these two plates that are grinding up against each other. One of them is North America and one of them is Pacific Rim. We're part of the Pacific Rim as much as we are part of North America. And that there's something even about that tension and about the relationship to the East, not just to Eastern mysticism, which is so important to the Visionary State book, but also a kind of way of thinking about technology, a way of thinking about the relationship of the subject to society. That's very different, and that has a lot to do with technological culture.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it's real. I mean, there's so much there. I mean, I will invite you back now if you have the interest sometime next year to continue the conversation and really to focus more on your newer work. Let me ask you the final question and then offer you opportunity to point out any places where people can learn more about your work, which is what I alluded to earlier. Where are we headed today?
Yeah, the where we headed question.
Yes, I always give the crystal ball thing, and I say I know that no one has a crystal ball, and I hated it as a litigator. People would say, "Are we going to win the case?" I'll do my best. We'll figure it out. So with that caveat.
Sure. Well, I'll give myself a little break here by just reminding people that they can access a lot of my writing on www.technosis.com. I put in most of my articles that I've had there and selections from my books. And if you want to see the photographs for The Visionary State, please go to the website, which is www.visionarystate.com. And Michael Rauner took really beautiful photographs of a lot of the very strange and beautiful sacred buildings and sites in California. And that's really half of the book. So I encourage you to at least go and look at some of the pictures. But the where are we headed? Well, I in the spirit of technosis, which is as pessimistic as it is optimistic, I will give a kind of cautious optimism and then I'll wax slightly apocalyptic in a very specific way. I will not give you the environmental apocalypse is a story we all know very well, and in fact, to my mind, it offers one of our greatest hopes, in the sense that if we are able to, as individuals, as a society, as a global society, to somehow find a way to shift the goals, to shift the agenda, that the incredibly creative and ingenious and hungry aspects of human potential will be able to actually deal with a lot of the things. Now, that might still be a total unpleasant situation for millions of people. I don't really see how we're going to get out of that unless the angels or the aliens actually arrive. Nonetheless, I see around me tons of potential, tons of possibility, and it's It's at once a political matter, a cultural matter, but it's also a spiritual matter in the sense that we have the goals that we are now programmed into our system, partly because they come out of the depths of who we are, and that shifting those goals requires shifts in consciousness as well as shifts in cultural priorities and technological developments. That might sound a little New Age, but it's something I think we're all really engaged with. As you sit there and you go, oh, I'm collecting more stuff so that my grandchildren can live in a, you know, a ruined hulk of a planet. Well, how am I going to shift my priority? How do I actually make the world a better place for them? And that, requires a different shift of priority that I think a lot of people are struggling with. The more apocalyptic side is that I think that we are run the risk, and it may happen whether we want it to or not, or there may be ways to mollify it, and it may not be as intense as what I imagine, but that as we couple our communications devices and our media ever more tightly to our experiential flow of subjectivity, our actual, our life of desire, the way that we communicate, the way that we are with each other, the way we dream, the way we desire, as this coupling becomes more and more intimate, that the kinds of feedback loops that we will get let loose will have consequences that we can't really see around. So the way that the transhumanists talk about the singularity as being the point when the machines grow so much more intelligent, we can't really control it anymore, and we're not able to predict it anymore. I think we have a version of a kind of singularity coming that involves how networked we are with each other, and also involves this question about privacy we talked earlier. Mm-hmm. As we kind of unfold the interior of ourselves and wire it into these social intense networks, that we're really altering some very basic qualities of the self and the way that the self experiences itself, and that there will be significant, you know, bounce back from that, and that we're seeing it to some degree already. I think attention, the sort of discussion around attention and Asperger's and that is a bit of that. It's like a forward wave of something that might actually become much more noticeable, at least for those of us who aren't mutants yet. I mean, maybe the 8-year-olds today are just going to ride through it smiling with thumbs up. But
right.
You know, so it's going to get generational, really intense.
Well, on that fairly apocalyptic view, Eric, I want to thank you for coming on Hearsay Culture today and for this wide-ranging discussion. And I look forward to having you back sometime in 2007.
Great, thank you.
You were listening to Hearsay Culture and Eric Davis, author of the book Technosis as well as The Visionary State. I'm really thrilled to have Eric come down here today and do the show and really discuss these issues. I do have to say again that Technosis, the book, is such a phenomenal read. And for anyone that's interested in any of the issues that we discuss, but really just thinking about where technology comes from, I strongly recommend the book. By way of closing the show, I do want to point out that the conversation today with Eric kind of leads me in a number of directions with the guests that I have coming up, and I wanted to run down them quickly. I've been quite busy with other things I have going, as much as I love to be doing Hearsay Culture regularly. But coming up on November 29th, I'm going to be talking to Associate Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall, who's taking a look at web search engines and their potential regulation, a theory that he has that we're going to explore. Coming into December, I'm excited to have on Professor Ann Finkbeiner from Johns Hopkins, who's written a fascinating book called The Jasons, The Secret History of Science's Postwar Elites, which is a study of this organization, this informal organization called The Jasons, which were made up of really some of the most preeminent and well-known and not-so-well-known scientists of the post-World War II era, who basically went on secret assignments for various government agencies to figure out problems. It's a fascinating history, and I'm looking forward to talking to Anne. December 13th, adjunct professor Paul Duguid from UC Berkeley School of Information is going to be coming on to discuss his fascinating book, The Social Life of Information. On the 20th of December, we're returning back to Stanford. Balazs Bodo, who's the Fulbright visiting researcher at CIS, where I'm a resident fellow, is taking a look at the sociocultural impacts of technology and online communities, and how communities in Eastern Europe have been allowed to get information that they otherwise would not be able to access simply because the technology is there. And this is technology that's both legal and illegal under U.S. law. So he's taking a look at these sociocultural impacts, and I'm looking forward to speaking to him. After Christmas, I'm going to have on Professor Henry Chesbro from Berkeley's Haas School of Business, who wrote a few years ago a fascinating book called Open Innovation, the idea that sharing information in fact benefits businesses, and that we don't necessarily need the kind of structures that we've had before to encourage innovation and encourage development. And it's a very challenging area, both in business law and also in intellectual property, and Henry will be a great guest, and I look forward to that talk. Finally, at the end of the year and going into January, I have booked through mid-January, and Professor Emeritus Richard Lanham of UCLA, who's really a rhetoric expert and an English professor of a very high regard, has written a fascinating book called The Economics of Attention, which is something that Eric and I were discussing briefly, and he takes a look at technology's impact on people's ability to simply concentrate and gather information and retain it and process it. And it's a book that has just come out, and I'm looking forward to discussing that with him. Finally, mid-January, Harry Surdin, who's the new resident fellow at Stanford Center for Computers and the Law, the Codex Center, which is an interdisciplinary program through Stanford Law School, as well as the Computer Engineering Department and Computer Science Department here at Stanford, is going to be discussing what Codex is doing, and particularly how they're using computers and looking at computers in ways that are quite challenging in terms of creation of law and enforcement of law. So Harry, who's a recent graduate of Stanford Law School, is going to be a great guest, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. As always, I encourage you to send me any comments, suggestions for future guests, people to talk to. I'm always excited to hear your remarks. I think it's extremely helpful to the show. So I want to thank you again for listening to KZSU. I'm Dave Levine, a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and please stay tuned for the great programming, music from Mike on KZSU. Thanks a lot.